Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that. That wasn't actually a shameless promotion for Copyright Clearance Center. That part was supposed to have been taken off. But I think that really sets the tone for today's session, just how much material. We all know there's a lot of material out there, and it's being used in a lot of different ways. But what about copyright? Because it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue every day. And Web 2.0 and the prevalence of user-generated content has really blown this really sky high. And talking about the original creator and the downstream creator, how do the two manage the content? How do the two manage each other? Lynn Ridley said it best when she said the consumer and the creator are blurring. But what also is blurring is the concept, is the rules around the IP, rules around IP, and what we need to think about when we're providing tools and technology to our users that allow all of our content to be put out there in a lot of different ways. We're going to have a very interactive discussion, I hope, today. This is a pretty passionate discussion. We were just in a conference room talking about this, and we'll probably still be in there letting yank these guys out of here and there because it's such heady stuff. So we're going to hear from three experts in the field. The first, as you can see, will be Greg Merkel, who's the Vice President Creative Director of Dow Jones. Greg's in a unique position where he works for a traditional publisher of content, but they are also delivering this content in very innovative ways. And he's a thought leader in this area, so he's kind of, you'll see, he's kind of in the middle there a little bit on the subject. Dan Gisolfi, who's the IT software architect in the Emergent Internet Technologies Group at IBM. And by the way, if you're going to have a panel, either you're afraid about working this thing, have somebody from IBM on your panel. But, he's going to talk about, you're going to see some pretty interesting stuff because they have some technology that enables building of mashups. And I think a couple of people in this room especially will be interested in what they see up there. And last but not least, the voice of reason, the lawyer. We have Robert Lands, who is the partner with Viner, Stevens & Innocent out of London, and he's going to come and talk to us a little about what's going on in the international stage in terms of copyright and how the law kind of is putting maybe constraints on this. Maybe the law needs to change. Maybe it needs to be reinterpreted. Let's see. So enough of me. Without further ado, Greg, please.
It's a real pleasure to be here. My name is Greg Merkel. I have a really unique role in the Enterprise Media Group where I have the ability to envision what the user experiences can be around information. So creative director is not necessarily a marketing job function. I do a lot of visioneering, if you will, of how users will interact with information and how to engineer software. I thought I'd just make sure we're just talking about this sort of ecosystem of users. I wanted to just use this as an example. In the corporate enterprises we serve, and actually within the entire 2.0 information sharing environment, you have essentially three classifications: someone who creates content, you have people who participate, and then you have readers. And after speaking, there's actually another list called the couch potatoes who sit on the extreme periphery of the overall information ecosystem. What's interesting about this overall ecosystem or this user base is that the creators are publishers. Traditionally, they were the journalists and editors. And now creators are bloggers. It could be the combined output of a wiki. The participants could have been individuals historically who wrote in part of the op-ed, sort of editorial component of a newspaper. And now that participatory environment is so rich, full of opinion, commentary. And then readers who just consume information. So I thought thought I'd just sort of set the stage by creating and envisioning a portal view where I actually wanted to start to pull information together from multiple sources. In the world that I'm now investigating, in the corporate enterprise, where they are trying to build very high-performance information dashboards by creating very high-performance workflow applications, putting information into the context of the user's workflow, we're starting to see the emergence of consumerization, the trends of personalized home moving into the enterprise. So I wanted to just envision building a dashboard. So I have an RSS feed. Before I get to that, I just wanted to poll the audience. Who uses an RSS feed reader as a primary means of reading news in the audience? So three of you, four. So Lynn mentioned digital natives this morning. I'm a digital immigrant, so I use a reader. I use traditional means as well, but I pretty much consume all of my information via RSS because I think I have about 250 feeds that I like to read. And it's impossible to get to that using the PAPDR technology. So, back to the portal. So, an RSS feed from Factiva, which is a user-defined subject. So, I want a feed of content that's around a specific subject. I can get RSS feed directly from a publisher, and I can also aggregate them. If there's a wiki internally, I can get the RSS feed of the wiki, the conversation, and everything. If there are internal bloggers, I can get the RSS feed from that internal blog. And then there's something called Yahoo Pipes. I'd like to be able to get some content from Yahoo Pipes. RSS from an external blog, which I may not have any control over. RSS from a Dapper, and then a data set from Swivel. So I just wanted to show that there's eight varieties of RSS on this one single screen. And just to go a little bit deeper into it, we're talking about Dapper, and maybe going through some of these applications. Dan is going to cover this in probably much greater detail. But this morning, as we were talking, Dan created, and I actually captured, Dapper actually enables you to go get data from a website that doesn't provide syndication, RSS or XML. So we actually went to the British Library, and we created a feed, and you can save it as XML or RSS. Swivel is actually a data repository of statistical information that's uploaded. And there's census data there, government consumption data, private information. Really interesting. But this was just a screen grab of estimated price by the acquirer for Web 2.0 companies. And there's a list of about 100. I just limited it to 10. And the stats are available in a graphical form, which I can then share with a table file, etc. It's really, really quite powerful. Yahoo Pipes, this was actually an interesting feed from CNET. It's a green technology and energy news. So it looks like a simple list of headlines. It's actually aggregated by using a visual development tool called Pipes. And Dan can probably go into much greater detail with this. But I can essentially go to URLs and build some rules. I went to blogs.cnet.com and I'm looking for keyword energy. Blogs.cnet.com, looking for keyword green. URLs, creating some filters, outputting them, combining them, deduping them, sorting them, filtering them by date, and then outputting them as RSS. This tool exists today. So just to show you sort of the rich development environments that are emerging, there are 2.0 development environments. So going back to my little dashboard, imagine all these mechanisms powering this environment, and actually really didn't require a heavy development environment. Another area that we'll talk about in our conversation are emerging standards, ACAP, which is Automated Content Access Protocol, and XRML. And there's Onyx, there are some other standards, so if anyone in the audience is interested in that or anyone has any other information to share, it would be great to talk about that as well. So I'm going to hand it over to Dan.
About from a tops-down view of how to create a mashup or a portal, as you described. portals don't always have to be just RSS feeds. They can be very interactive widgets and gadgets. And so there's a whole space, a whole ecosystem out there from NetVibes, Google Gadgets, Microsoft's got their PopFly with blocks and so on. What's happening across the web is that you have the web becoming the palette of software building blocks. And so at IBM, and what I've been doing for the past couple of years as a mashup enabler, is going off and being able to take content, work with content providers like Greg and Dow Jones, and be able to enable their clients to be able to take that content, those building blocks, and be able to enable creation of new situational applications or mashups. And when you think about that, those situational applications are going to be very much the combination of disparate data from a variety of different sources. So as a content provider, as a publisher in the audience, you don't know in the long tail of Web 2.0 where your content's going to be. If you're afraid of that, that's part of the discussion we're going to be having here today. If you're going to embrace the long tail, well then, at what point do you want your content to be out there, available, accessible, and then what limits do you want to put on it? So what Greg, in his introduction, actually gave you is an introduction to some of the tools that are out there, like Dapper, like Swivel. And what I want, I'm just putting Dapper's site up here. There's no relationship with Dapper. They're just actually a company out of Israel. But what Dapper and Swivel and some of these companies out there on the web today introduced to you is that every one of you in the audience as non-programmers can walk up to these tools, create yourself new content from existing content, maybe even your own company's site, and then publish that new content as a new conduit, a new widget, to be shared or used in situational applications. Again, so that a knowledge worker or a situational application developer, as I like to call them, mashup assemblers, can go and create. So in IBM, one of the tools we've been creating for this space is something called QED Wiki. And QED Wiki is a mashup maker. Now, I'm not going to spend time, I want to focus on copyrights, the issue of copyright here today. So I'm not going to focus on the tool, and I'll gladly demo this for anybody who wants to see it. What I do want to show is point out through this very simple example some of the problems. Okay, so after arriving here last night and getting the pamphlet of the folks that were attending, I just went and looked at a couple of the sites from attendees, and I looked at British Library and the Berkshire Publishing sites. Now, these are two sites that didn't have RSS feeds that I was going to pick up quickly, but I was able to create my own RSS feeds, and I used Dapper to do that. And what we're going to be talking about, my role here today, is to introduce to you some of the issues or problems, some of the things you should think about as publishers. So the first thing you should think about in this mashup, or I like to call it the mashboard, is this is very personal. This is Dan's research page. I created it. At no point have I told you I'm sharing it. I can share it with my colleagues. But you don't know where Dan's scope is with this page that I've created. The second thing is you can say that Dan put his name on that, right? The other thing you can see here is that I told you that I went to British Library, but I called it Web 2.0 Library. I also went to Berkshire Publishing, but I called it My American News Search Engine. And I'm just going to interact with these two Dapper dApps. I'm going to put in China here. And I'll go off and do an RSS query on that. And while that's going off, I'm going to... Our internet connection's not. Ouch. Bear with me, folks. Doesn't like a live connection, huh?
You have to re-authenticate.
What's that?
Did you have to re-authenticate through the iBomb?
I hope not, but let's see. Yeah, it should be up. Okay, let's give this one a shot. So I'm going to enter China for each one of these searches. All right, that's off the line. And these are running two dynamic searches against British Library and Berkshire Publishing. I'm also going to do a search here on China, and that's going to go off and hit the Financial Times. Now, a couple of things are happening here, and issues that you should think about as a mashup. Those publishers in the room, does Berkshire and British Library, are they comfortable with having their content on the same page as Financial Times? Is the British Library comfortable with the fact that Dan didn't put the British Library's title down? He put Web 2.0 Library. Same thing for Berkshire. Okay. Conversely, isn't it cool that their content is being made available at this low level? You know, Dan, Joe Sixpack out there working with this content. Now, if I want to drill into this content, you can see that I really can't get far here on the British Library. I'm probably just going to get a summary of information that was given to me off of the newsfeed, right? But if I went to this link, I'll probably be challenged for information to get there. And if I went to Berkshire, the same thing, I'm just going to get just a lead into the information, okay? A couple of things to just point out about these types of widgets. These two widgets that I have here from Dapper, we've classified these as standalone widgets. As you notice, I had to interact independently with each one of those. They're just scripts, web scripts. Whereas when I clicked in this section here, in this form, I could have put Iraq, for example, and I, through our mashup maker, we were able to wire that interaction to an RSS feed search against the Financial Times. So as you think about the ways your content can be published, in using the use of mashup makers, you want to be able to make sure that the end user is able to interact with your content as well as other content on the same page. And that's where mashup makers and some of the technology around Web 2.0 become interesting. So with that, I hope I've painted some of the issues and interesting comments or discussion points for us to open this up. Do you want to?
Yeah, let's go back to the first. So I expected maybe some jaws to drop. I'm looking at Karen. I mean, when I had the privilege of spending the day at the IBM Research Labs where I first saw this from Dan, and I guess my face turned white because this goes beyond just links. This goes into cutting and pasting and sending these things out, and this is your content. So that's really what we want to talk about today. And I think that's a great lead-in. So what about copyright law? I mean, where does that come in, and did something just get violated there? I think so. There was no...
What about moral rights, and what does that mean from European standpoint, the rights of attribution?
Just to expand on that question, which is what about moral rights, in case people don't really know where that question is coming from, in Europe we have a system of moral rights that goes alongside copyright. So the creator of a copyright work has certain rights that can't be transferred generally. Rights like the right to be identified as the author, the right to object to derogatory treatment of their work.
It's really well classified and developed because it's written by lots and lots of people whose names need to go up.
Right. Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk about attribution being the key issue, but it's more than attribution because, I, as an author of one of those things in Dan's presentation, I may want my name to be credited as the author, but I may not if he's combined my stuff with other people's stuff, and it may look bad for me. So moral rights are quite a complex issue in Europe anyway. In the States, I believe it's not really part of copyright law. I haven't got any slides, and if I did, they'd probably be very boring compared to these guys. But I thought maybe if this is very sophisticated stuff. If we sort of take a step back and look at what's going on now in the courts, because that's the future, we might be able to see kind of what the problems might be and the possible solutions. You probably realise that it's every IP lawyer's favourite sport to sue either Google or YouTube. Lots of that going on. Google is being sued in Belgium and also by a French news agency in America over its Google News service. And that does, although rather embryonic, say, compared to this, a similar thing where it will take headlines and a sentence or two from the start of a news report and put it together on a page. And in Belgium, a Belgian court said that that was a copyright infringement and it made Google stop linking to those Belgian news services that it was taking content from. And Google actually got a little revenge in there by blocking the site completely from Google, so you couldn't even find the newspaper in doing a web search. But they kind of interpreted the ruling a little too literally, deliberately. That case kind of shows the copyright is not the same the world over. In the UK, I don't think Google's news service would be an infringement, actually, because taking a headline is not a copyright infringement, because a headline is too short to be a literary work. And taking the first line of a story probably isn't taking a substantial part of that story. So it's not an infringement, but the law may be different in Belgium. And that's one of the issues with these with copyright using these new web services, because copyright is not the same all over the world. YouTube is getting sued because, A, it has money, and so people think it's worth suing them. Nobody bothered suing them until Google bought them. And two, because it's publishing copyright material quite often that's submitted by users. And in doing so, it's doing what these services would like to do. It's making a reproduction of that work, and that's an unlawful activity. It's also, under English law, infringing the right of communication to the public. This is the right to make content available to people to download as and when they want to see it. It's the law's kind of reaction to technology, because in Europe we had a sort of rationalisation of copyright a few years ago where they said, look, previous law has said you've got a right to broadcast, you've got a right to make a cable transmission, but now technology is moving so quickly that we can't fit things into those small boxes anymore. So they changed the terminology and they said, instead of that, we'll make it a communication to the public right, so by any means. And that's what it would be alleged that YouTube is doing. In America, there's a similar thing, which is, to look at my notes, I'm not a US lawyer. But if I say anything that's just complete rubbish under American law or any other law, then tell me, because I'm an English lawyer. In America, they have a thing called contributory infringement, where YouTube didn't create the content, it didn't record a television show and publish it, one of its users did, but it could be liable for contributory infringement because it's then publishing that on. And if there's a defence, if they didn't know about it. But the argument is, it's currently being tested, they should have known about it because that's what everybody does with YouTube. So those issues are playing out right now, and we'd have to look at those and more in relation to these new Web 2 services, which are going far beyond that.
And what did you think about when you were thinking copyright law, when we had our discussion earlier on today and what you just saw? What did you think?
It was blind panic, really. The stuff there that's clearly fine. The stuff there that is on a traditional basis not being a problem before, you know, some of it is really just linking, and linking has never really been tested in the courts. There was a case in 1997 that involved one newspaper framing another newspaper's content, and they kind of tried to say, oh, it could be a trespass. They tried to look at old law to fit it to this new situation, but it was never really resolved, and it still isn't, but everybody links. It's been going on for years, so that kind of stuff is fine. Also, taking an RSS feed is generally going to be okay if you're just taking it and not repurposing it and modifying it, because this site providing the RSS feed is giving you an implied license to do so. It becomes much more complicated when you're not just taking the content and publishing it, but you're taking the content, mashing it up with other stuff, and then publishing it. Then it really could be a problem.
Right, and Dan, you took two RSS feeds and put them together and renamed them. And how do you feel about yourself right now?
I do anything wrong. And one of the things we talked about earlier, I want to point out to the crowd: if you think this is just something that you just saw and it's really not happening a lot, I think you're drastically wrong. This is very pervasive on the web today. And when we were discussing this in the conference earlier, I argued that this is no different from a blogger going off and
relinking back to other blogs or other news articles or other websites. The difference here is that in the case of like Yahoo Pipes, I can actually take content from two different RSS feeds and derive an entirely new RSS feed. Now, as an author of that RSS feed, I have two issues or two comments. One is that I feel that I can repurpose this content. I'm not making money on it. That's a different story. But I also feel that I want attribution for the RSS feed, just like the guys who I borrow from want attribution. Right? So this gets into, and Greg mentioned this earlier, about standards. I mean, we really, RSS and ADAM, some of the syndication technology that's out there today, does not deal with copyright attribution. And I think from the panelists here, I think we're in favor of that.
Yeah. I think one of the wonderful things about standards is that they standardize. That means it opens up exchange, the interchange of ideas, the interchange of information. RSS was considered to be a very disruptive technology early on, and a syndication technology. So its primary goal was to get content into other environments and drive usage back to websites. It's evolved into something much, much, much richer. And in fact, the RSS specification is evolving to facilitate that the adaptation of the original format. And I mentioned standards earlier, that the standards are emerging and are just starting to take into consideration these downstream use cases of how information is actually being consumed and where it's being consumed. And as Dan mentioned, it's pervasive and you're not going to stop it. And we talked earlier about there are two paths you can take. You can either build a thicker and higher wall around your content, or you can actually take a very close look at the social phenomenon of being able to repurpose and remix information and understand how rights can be infused into that environment. I work for Dow Jones. We're publishers. So we publish the Wall Street Journal. We have the Wall Street Journal online and many other online consumer websites. Out of those websites, we do produce RSS feeds. They're available to registered subscribers. The experience is very contained. A user clicks on a link. The link could be available anywhere. And the user is then driven back to the site. It drives advertising impressions. Essentially, it's a linkage model. The problem gets a little more interesting when the RSS feeds are synthesized out of multiple data sets, as what Dan put together. We serve corporate enterprises as a different line of business for the B2B market, where we serve a corporate enterprise with products like Factiva. And we then we ask that the enterprise sign a global license for all of their users. And essentially, we are then managing the royalties, the rights, the distribution of that information on behalf of the IPs through our product. It's a very expensive proposition to architect that kind of authentication mechanism for the massive data sets we have. And we're now meeting with clients who use our content, and they're taking some of the practices that are emerging on the outside, the Web 2.0 practices of mashing up, and creating something called an enterprise mashup, where they're actually creating APIs and almost Dapper-like and pipe-like interfaces into their own data. Imagine Yahoo Pipes into their CRM, because it's so hard to get information out of it, and then remixing it. That's when it's an incredibly gray area with regard to the reuse of that information.
Yeah, I don't know what the other publishers in the room think, and I think, you know, Greg's in a unique position because he works for a semi-traditional publisher, but obviously, you know, forward-looking publisher, but also is in, I guess, the new technology kind of area. But I don't know if that is a gray area that much, because you just talked about a lot of content being put out into their own RSS feeds, and I just assume they're distributing them. They're not just sitting and reading them themselves. So I don't know if any... Kate, do you want to comment on that?
I'm not a publisher in first place. We're a technology company. But this is an issue I'm quite concerned about, because what we do is we have a couple of products. We deal a lot with authenticating materials. I'm not talking about that. But we have a couple of products where we're not mashing up, or whatever term you want to use, 2 RSS feeds, but 350 RSS feeds. And We have another one which does blog alerts. We're accessing 32 million blogs and doing all sorts of things, but we always have attribution, always, without exception. We also serve up the full story, whether it's a blog or a news story, whatever it is. And we don't mess around with it if the users do. That's another issue. So, but what concerns me is blogging, anybody can do anything with the stories that we serve up, but other than the name of the blog and where it comes from, and the creator or whatever you want to call it of the blog, there doesn't seem to be any protection involved. I don't know what the legal issues are around it. It's something we are concerned about as a company providing this technology.
So, because there's protection for the author of the blogs, and there also should be protection for you as a publisher, because you're going to be liable if something is defamatory in one of those blogs, or if, an example that I gave you earlier, if there's medical information, for example, and the dosage is incorrect. So there's that issue as well as the copyright issue. But from a copyright standpoint, the problem I think I have as a lawyer, which is a problem that a lot of people have with sort of Google Books and that kind of thing, is that what's going on there is you're sort of taking the content and saying, I can take your content and repurpose it unless you tell me not to, which goes against what the law actually says, which is that you've got a right to prevent people doing anything unless they ask your permission, apart from certain defences and things. So that's the problem with it.
So, you know, one thought there is, in fact, it was in the keynote this morning about embracing the long tail. I think all the publishers in the audience have to come up with some sort of threshold for their business. At what point do they embrace Web 2.0 and the long tail? And when they do so, what is this tactical or long-term strategy for addressing what content can be made available and to what extent, and by whom, and for what purposes? Is the British Library going to go after Dan for putting that little dap up there? Well, I mean, maybe it'll cost you to hire a lawyer to do that, right?
I'll do it for free.
So efficient. No, you have to really think about, when is it worth, when is it justified going after governments? And then what we were talking about earlier is, in a sense, Dapper and our tool and a lot of these mashups are just conduits for the information. The end user is the one who's using the information. And at that point, what does that end user do with it? And maybe that's where copyright comes into play. So I just like the fact that there's a lot of questions being asked here. There's a lot of activity going on the web. This is being done all over. Bloggers do it. Mashup assemblers do it. And if content publishers want their information to get out there to places where they never thought they would be accessible, and they want to embrace the long tail, they're going to have to bring down some of that wall, as Greg pointed out earlier.
I'm really interested in business implications, so I just wanted to share my first reaction to that, which is reminding me, I run on sustainability and have for some time, and back in the early 90s, when there was, you know, a lot of environmental activity, a friend of mine sent me a clipping from Edmonton, London, sent me a clipping from the Spokane Washington newspaper, and said, I thought you'd be interested in this, and I'm reading this article about what you can do to save the planet. And I'm reading along, and if you send it there, it sends it to me. And I read a little further, and I said, what sends that to me? And I'm looking at it, there's, you know, it's written by some newspaper reporter, and I'm completely baffled. And then I finally got the blog, and it's syndicated from the Knight Ridder News Service. And I thought, what is this? And I investigated, and I had written an article for a London newspaper. And some of it had been stolen and reprinted as part of an article by someone else in a Canadian magazine, and then syndicated to my reader. But the thing is, I recognized my own words instantly. No attribution. And so I look at this as I'm a publisher, and I'm concerned about the business and the copyright. But I'm really concerned about the authors and the creative experience. And so when I see, you pulled up a clip, at least it had the author's name on it. But it need not have. I mean, you could do a feed, and it could just be stuff written by anybody. It could be merged with other things. And I think that, you know, as a publisher, you really do have a responsibility there, too. I mean, a responsibility to the creators and a responsibility to our customers.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that's right. We talked about that earlier, that awareness is a big part of it. Both awareness, your own awareness and awareness of your, of the users that are using these tools and what they can and can't do. And at the same point, like these guys were talking about, do you lower the wall a little bit? Because copyright law, at least in the United States, has not changed. The law is the law. So if Kate, you're pasting an article on a blog, and I don't think you are, but if you are and pass and sending it out, that's, you know, that current copyright law tells you that you can't do that. And I think that what, you know, struggling with or wanting to make aware to y'all is, you know, these guys are built, Dan and his team and people are building tools that make this so easy. So it's such a conundrum. And I think Dan even has a little bit of a different opinion on, is it, you know, violating some of copyright or not?
And well, I mean, I, like I mentioned before, you know, we've discussed, I really feel that RSS and Atom, those specifications need to be updated to have metadata and bad attribution in there. So, I mean, I'm all for that. And I think, you know, the tooling vendors out there have no problem following spec and handing that information, give the spec in. Right now, it's spec stone. And we also must need to, we need to make sure it's simple. Because as a blogger, I'm sure you go through this every time you go to a link to another site. It stops your train of thought writing, right? And so, you know, when I'm going off as a master assembler creating a page like Greg laid out for you, I'm trying to think about all the data intersections between those.
Fair. Make sure I put, you know.
Yeah, you want to give attribution, but you know, you also want, I have a job to do here, right? And you know, from an IBM perspective, our focus here is at one side of the application spectrum. We're focusing on situational applications, the situational needs of end users, or knowledge workers. And when you're in a situation, you don't want to be bogged down by certain things, you know? And so I also think that the point of copyright also comes into at what point does it get published. If I created that application on my desktop, do I need to deal with attribution? How many of you have Excel documents on your desktop that you cut and paste stuff into? Did you give attribution? Did you need to? It sit on your desktop. You never emailed it anywhere. So my point is, at the point of publishing the mashup or situational app or sharing it, I think that attribution becomes important. So I know I'm saying a lot of things that people aren't happy with.
This is going to sound stupid, but I mean, how do you put attribution? Because I would like to see both the author and maybe the source. I would like it to be at least very good. I'd like to have my company brand. I mean,
I think the emerging standards for RSS today is not a very rich container for the information. There's another version called Atom, ATOM, or anyone familiar with it. Essentially, it has more descriptive name value pairs in the XML. ACAP actually takes into consideration the author, the rights to the, and potentially even sub-rights to the content, where the content may be have a bibliographic reference, or there may be media embedded into that article, which has a different set of rights than the actual container. So it's a very thick problem when it comes to rights, and there are gross rights and net rights, just like a film would have. The standards are just beginning to take into consideration the downstream consumption. So I think the question is, how can the technology do that for the user? It's actually, I don't think it can effectively. I think that it's incumbent on the publisher to actually create with a standard.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.